You're listening to This Week in Cardiology from theheart.org on Medscape.
Hi, everyone. This is John Mandrola from theheart.org on Medscape. This is This Week in Cardiology for August 7th, 2015. This week, I'm taping from my writing room in my home. I'm going to talk to you about new oral anticoagulant drugs versus warfarin, ICD generator changes, obesity, the social determinants of health, ABIM, and valsartan sacubitril. First up, I wanted to talk about the question of what anticoagulant to start with. In practice, one of the many reasons why NOAC drugs have an advantage is that they have immediate anticoagulation. A patient presents with atrial fibrillation. He is in the system, and everyone is worried. So the reflex is to get going with a NOAC drug. There is immediate anticoagulation. Warfarin takes time to get adjusted, and INRs can fluctuate. So it's intuitive to believe that NOAC drugs are better in the short term. But an interesting study from France suggests that warfarin and NOAC drugs produce the same results in the first 3 months. These researchers used two nationwide databases and propensity matching to compare outcomes of patients with non-valvular atrial fibrillation who were treated with either dabigatran and rivaroxaban or warfarin. They found similar rates of bleeding and similar rates of thrombosis. I went back and looked at the Kaplan-Meier curves from the RELY trial and ROCKET trial and found that they indeed did take a number of months to separate. And although this study has its limitations, primarily confounding by indication, it does hint at equivalence in the first 3 months of the two strategies. It also suggests, as the authors emphasize, that there's a need to be equally cautious with NOAC drugs than with warfarin. One of the toughest calls in electrophysiology is the decision surrounding ICD generator change. Yet another study, the largest to date, suggests that patients implanted with an ICD change significantly over time. Researchers from Johns Hopkins University looked at a subset of the PROS ICD trial, which was a four-center prospective observational trial of primary prevention ICDs. This subset had more than 500 patients in it, and they used this group because they had serial echocardiograms available after the initial ICD implant. They found 40% of patients had improvement of their ejection fraction, 23% had improvement over 35% ejection fraction. And those that had that kind of improvement had significantly lower rates of ICD therapy. Only 4 of 126 patients who had EF greater than 35% had ICD therapy. Wow, this is significant. Consider that patients who have primary prevention ICDs have grown older and likely sicker. They have lived with their device. They may have changed views on end of life and goals of care. And now, if they have a better ejection fraction, you can see how the benefits risks of generator change may be significantly different from the initial implant. One thing that I feel is very important in this situation is that we avoid using stilted language. When we talk about sudden cardiac death as tragic, when we use words like need and safe in relation to ICDs, we risk tilting the conversation towards what we believe is best rather than what may be best for the patient. I'm working on a column right now on the language of paternalism in ICDs. Next up is obesity. The weight loss and diabetes remission of sleeve gastrectomy wanes at 5 years. These were the findings of a new cohort study published in the JAMA Surgery. Investigators from Israel looked at 443 patients that were operated under and underwent bariatric surgery in their university hospital from 06 to 13. They showed that significant weight loss occurred in 77% of patients at 1 year, but that number dropped to about 50% at 5 years. Likewise, remission of diabetes occurred in 51% of patients at 1 year, but that number dropped to 20% at 5 years. This is unsurprising news that has both good and bad connotations. The good news is that a substantial number of patients got better with the surgery, but the bad news is that durability of results seems to be difficult to come by. And I'm no expert in bariatric surgery, but I do see a lot of patients with obesity. Mechanically compressing an organ seems like a very focal and simple solution to a very complicated systemic problem. It's sort of like burning the left atrium for patients with persistent AF, isn't it? There was two pieces of news from ABIM this week. One was an Annals of Internal Medicine report, which attempted to quantify the extra burden from maintenance of certification, or MOC. UCSF researchers reported two main findings. One was that the costs and the hours spent certifying have increased significantly in the last 10 years, and another was that costs range from anywhere of $23,000 to more than $40,000 for some subspecialists. Time away from practice accounted for the most of the cost. The authors concluded that these were considerable costs given that there is no definitive outcome data on the ABIM brand of MOC. Not surprisingly, Dr. Richard Barron, president of ABIM, writing in an editorial, disagreed. The second piece of ABIM news was that ABIM announced that new fellows who pass the certifying examination would be certified. And that sounds obvious, right? But it wasn't until this week fellows who passed the exam actually got certified, because the previous policy required fellows still had to enroll and pay for MOC before they were listed as board certified. And I don't know how else to look at this policy and not think that it's egregious and a complete money grab. I mean, it's great that ABIM reversed a bad policy, but my question is, why was such a bad policy in place in the first place? I want to give a big shout out to the AHA for their release of a new type of scientific statement. They called it the Social Determinants of Risk and Outcomes for Cardiovascular Disease. In this statement, the AHA says ignoring factors such as education, income, and living environment could negate the progress that we're making in preventing death from cardiovascular disease. Death from cardiovascular disease may be decreasing steadily in the U.S., but it still represents, in absolute terms, a huge burden. And like our economy, the AHA makes note of significant inequalities in cardiovascular care. I'm sorry, you guys, but I love this paper, and you might think it's not relevant to clinical practice, but I think physicians have a moral obligation to engage in public health advocacy. We have a tremendous amount of capital in the public space. Let's use it to promote cardiovascular disease prevention. And I'm not just saying this because I've started commuting to work on my bike, and I can barely get to my hospital because of a lack of infrastructure here. I'm saying this because I believe the answer to lowering death rates from cardiovascular disease doesn't happen in the cath lab. It happens in the neighborhoods we live in, the schools we send our kids to, and the parks we play in. Finally, I want to close by recommending an outstanding feature from my colleague and fellow Heart.org on Medscape contributor, Dr. Seth Bilazarian. Seth took issue with my Valsartan sacubitril piece. He disagreed with nearly every one of my 10 reasons to go slow with Valsartan sacubitril. He gave a cogent explanation of why I was wrong on each point. Now, I still disagree with him, but it was a great piece. take a look and see who you think is closer to the truth. And the cool thing about the digital age is that we'll be able to look back and see who was right and who was less right. So this is it for this week in cardiology. Until next week, this is John Mandrola from theheart.org on Medscape.
You're listening to This Week in Cardiology from theheart.org on Medscape.